We are familiar with the short-term debt cycle or short-term debt cycle, but we are not really familiar because of the great time span of 75 to 100 years. There is a long-term debt cycle, which we are right now at the peak probably, and this is why I'm really looking forward to talk to Dylan Leclerc, who works at Bitcoin Magazine, also co-founder of 21pragmatism.com. He wrote an excellent article on the conclusion of the long-term debt cycle and the rise of Bitcoin, and is hyper-Bitcoinization in reality the coming of the debt jubilee? So without further ado, this is going to be my really exciting talk with Dylan Leclerc. And let me know what you think. If you have any questions, please write an email to kd@kvandervan.com or DM me on Twitter. And I'm really looking forward to this talk. Hope you're going to enjoy this. Well, welcome to the show, Dylan. Dylan Leclerc, how are you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on. Excited to talk.
Yeah, Dylan, I mean, you came out of nowhere. I mean, I didn't know you, to be honest with you, before. You are co-founder of 21 Pragmatism and content creator on Bitcoin Magazine. And you made some really, you wrote a mind-boggling article, which a really comprehensive article on the long debt cycle and Bitcoin. But before we get into that, would you tell my listeners what's your path into the rabbit hole of Bitcoin, and what was the reason, motivation, intention of writing this article?
So my rabbit hole journey, it was over the last couple of years. I'm 20 years old. I kind of stumbled upon Bitcoin at the end of 2017, but didn't think anything of it. Just had some people that I knew in like the ICO boom. I mean, I wasn't even old enough to log into an exchange or even know how to buy any of this stuff. But I started to want to like get in involved in investing. I didn't know, didn't even know what I didn't know. So looked up like best investors and was started reading a little bit about Warren Buffett and looked up the Investors podcast, just like not even knowing what that was, and stumbled upon Preston Pysh and the stuff that he's doing. And so I started reading a lot, read like Rich Dad Poor Dad and just basic like building blocks, like learning what an asset and a liability was, and just did a lot of studying. Because I mean, my goal was never to be rich. My goal now is freedom. And so money is power. And it gives you optionality in life with really anything. Like money itself isn't the goal, you know? And so I was on that path for a little bit, trying to like learn about value investing. And when I turned 18, I signed up for Robinhood and Coinbase, and I like was learning about stocks and whatnot, but really I have like a passion for just like, knowledge. I have a passion for learning, with really anything. I kind of have like an obsessive personality. And so in a like kind of a journey for truth, I kept learning a little bit more, and the legacy financial system is it doesn't make sense when, or I guess not doesn't make sense, but there's a lot of things wrong when you kind of peel back the onion, that is kind of you're supposed to accept as normal, and they don't, it's not normal. And so that kind of led me to Bitcoin. Not so much that I knew Bitcoin or crypto as I'm coming in as a newbie. Not that I knew that it was a solution, but I'm just learning it in parallel. This is just this kind of thing that me as a 17, as an 18-year-old kid, like I don't have any opposition to it because I don't know. I just don't know anything. And so I have a Twitter, and I had a Twitter, and I log on, and luckily I found the maximalist crowd really early on, which was great. Right when I turned 18, Plan B dropped his stock to flow model, and like Twitter was buzzing about it. And so I kind of luckily stumbled upon Bitcoin maximalist Twitter very early on, and that was the start of my rabbit hole journey. And like everybody that I could kind of see and knew what they were talking about, I tried to learn as much as I could from them. So a lot of books and podcasts over the past 2 years. But yeah, that was the start of my rabbit hole journey. And it's been a long, you know, a long, long way since, even though it's only been like 2 years, it's felt like a decade. And I guess to get to how I wrote this piece and why I did, in this journey of learning, and trying to figure out truth, I stumbled upon a lot of really, really smart people with things that I thought were important. Jeff Booth, his amazing book, The Price of Tomorrow. I wrote The Bitcoin Standard. And then finally, which was my piece was based off of, which was Ray Dalio's Big Debt Crises. That really contextualized for me when I read that. It was kind of an aha moment, like where we are in history right now, 2020, 2021 is big. It's really, really big. And so that was a point for me where Bitcoin is a nascent technology. It's a monetary asset, but it's what the world needs at this point. And so, yeah, I mean, I kind of went everywhere in the past 5 minutes there, but yeah, that's a quick rundown. Do you have any questions from there?
No, your article is really super structured, because, you know, you just mentioned Ray Dalio. I mean, the guy is a really interesting figure. Would you say one of the reasons that he just doesn't get it? I mean, even Greg Foss said recently, Greg Foss was on my show too. And then on Preston Pish's show, he also said, like, Ray Dalio like gets it to 99%, but, you know, I don't know what's preventing him like to get it, just to get it. Is it because, I mean, would you call Ray Dalio a cantillionaire? You know, sort of, he has had the privilege of profiting off, you know, of the whatever low interest rate, zero interest rate policies of the Federal Reserve, or, you know, just credit expansion, free money and flowing, you know, into all these megalomaniacs, you know?
Yeah. I think, yeah, Ray's really close. And he's actually, this Friday, I believe, he's talking at a Texas A&M Bitcoin conference, and he's talking right after Dan Held and Michael Saylor. So about Bitcoin as an investment asset class. So I think he's there, or at least there's people in his ear at Bridgewater that are there. I think it's tough. Like, I can't put myself in the shoes of a 60, 70 year old, whatever Ray is. As a 20-year-old, for me, it's like, I grew up and money's basically digital, you know, like Venmo and Cash App and all this stuff, like just the like digital scarcity. I mean, not understanding it at first, but when you dig into it, for me, like an internet native, I grew up on YouTube and Google and had a MacBook, and coming up through public school, like we were on laptops, you know, so digital cash is something that, like, you know, I can get, and I can, you know, like distinguish from like, I don't know, all these other crypto projects. But with Ray, and I don't think he's necessarily a technologist. He's a genius macroeconomist, and he's, you know, obviously a billionaire. But for Ray,
Dylan, does he really need to be? I mean, there are so many people out there who are not technologists. You know, I mean, even Zoomers, you know, like you or William Clemente or. Yeah. Joe Burnett, you know, these are Zoomers, you know, you've grown up with digital. It's like your second nature. It's your nature, actually, you know?
Yeah.
But is it really necessary to, you know, to understand, because, you know, I don't know how the TV works or the refrigerator or, you know, or the car. But he understands, he should be able to understand the monetary properties, the fundamental monetary properties of Bitcoin.
Yeah. I think Ray hasn't done the work of what makes Bitcoin different from another, like, I guess, crypto asset, or why is Bitcoin not MySpace? And I, like, that is something that a lot of people, like, don't. The biggest skeptics are, that's, like, I think one of the biggest hurdles is, like, wow, yeah, why is it different? And Bitcoin's launch, and it's almost like a one-off thing. It can never happen again, you know? And that's what I think Ray's missing. among all these other things, like when you call Bitcoin volatile, it that for me is like you haven't done the work at all. calling the least volatile thing in the world volatile is you're missing the forest for the trees.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Mm-hmm.
For me the article, I really tried because you know, debt cycles in itself and the monetary system that's based inherently like 100% on credit. People mm-hmm. like that is something that people don't understand. And like for me, like I did a lot of reading and research. And like the average person, you're not taught this in school. You're not taught this even in like economics. If you're like, I was studying economics my first year in college after I dropped out, like there was a basic level, like, you know, Econ 101 course about, you know, fractional reserve banking and all this stuff, but you don't learn really what money is. And you don't learn that everything that we think of money is really just credit, and banks create money through lending. Like that was something when I read like The Creature of Jekyll Island, and I had a moment where I was like, everything I know is a farce. Like,
exactly. What other books did you read, Dylan? I'm curious. Like, did you read like Tragedy and Hope?
I read,
like books like Tragedy and Hope. What's his author? I just forgot the author's name.
I've not read Tragedy and Hope. I read Big Debt Crises. It's a 3-part series. It's like the archetype. Then there's detailed case summaries, and then there's like a 48 debt crises that he used to basically form the archetype. So I read those in great detail. I read The Creature from Jekyll Island, which is all about, like, some people call it like conspiracy, but it's really just a detailed history of fractional reserve banking. I read The Price of Tomorrow, The Bitcoin Standard, all of the, you know, the necessary rabbit hole books. I have started Layered Money, haven't finished it. The Sovereign Individual, and all of those books kind of helped to shape my worldview, and helped me really navigate like this craziness, you know, of the world today, political sphere, system, just a lot of things that on the surface make no sense. And if you aren't paying attention and really doing a lot of the work, like everything seems to be in disarray. So that really kind of gave me some sort of clarity to what we're living through. And my goal with the piece, and it was quite long, I think it was like 3,500 words, and with all the charts and everything, it was like 20 pages. But for me, my goal was to help people around me with maybe an understanding of economics, but maybe not. Help kind of understand why Bitcoin, like why it's so necessary. And even if you don't like it or understand it or care to, it's a necessity that, you know, you can't insulate yourself from.
Dylan, I mean, you did a really excellent job. I mean, I'm just screen sharing here your article on bitcoinmagazine.com. It's called The Conclusion of the Long-Term Debt Cycle and the Rise of Bitcoin, with the subtitle, The Conclusion of a Long-Term Debt Cycle is an Inescapable Economic Reality that Coincides with the Ascent of the Bitcoin Network. Now, you lay out, you know, all the symptoms, you know, the consequences, second, third, fourth order effects, but then you really brilliantly describe like what are the root causes. And, you know, somewhere along the lines, you know, you also maybe you can break it out a little bit for my listeners, like what is the short-term cycle and the long-term cycle which we are in, like how far are we into that long-term cycle, or what do you believe is gonna, you know, is that something like, are we talking about years or months or decades, and you know, where you also lay out the, you know, the symptoms, like whatever the top 20 at the top 10% own whatever, like 50% of the wealth of the assets or whatever. So yeah, break it down if you want to.
Yeah, of course. So there's three main factors that kind of make up, or yeah. So there's the long-term productivity trend, which is a result of human entrepreneurship and ingenuity. And that happens regardless of credit cycles. And so credit cycles, the short and long-term debt cycle, is besides the productivity, that's kind of the volatility we feel as a society, as a global economic system, is a result of credit expansion and credit contraction, and not it's not just wildly fluctuating human ingenuity productivity. So debt in the most basic form is cyclical. So when you borrow today money to consume, invest, to spend, you're not only borrowing from a lender, but you're borrowing from your future self. So debt in the most basic way is cyclical. And it's even worse, or yeah, it's problematic when you borrow from your future self and it doesn't go to a productive investment or a productive use of that capital. So if I borrow money today to buy a TV that I couldn't afford otherwise, I'm basically promising away my future productivity output. And so that holds true at an individual level as well as a macroeconomic level. You see, if everybody, say in 2008, is borrowing to lever up and to buy houses, that is not a productive use of capital. And ultimately, if there is and when there is a credit contraction, a lot of people are gonna get burned. So we have the short-term debt cycle, which people most like, you could think of it as the business cycle or the boom and bust cycle. And most people, whether they understand it or not, have a basic sense of understanding of what the short-term debt cycle is. Oh, there's a recession, and oh, now we're out of the recession. And that comes around every 7 to 10 years. And most people may or may not know why, but it comes because interest rates, especially in the era of central banking, are centrally planned. The price of money is set. And so out of, say, a recession or just when interest rates are set, a lot of the borrowing is productive. It does go to growing the economy, but there is just naturally there is speculative activities happening, and the self-reinforcing upwards boom of a credit expansion, which is what happens in a monetary system, especially it's self-reinforcing to the upside, and a lot of that use of capital goes to malinvestment. It's misallocated. It's, you know, like buying a house on credit when it's tripled in the last 5 years is not an effective use. So ultimately there's an upwards boom, and followed by a downwards credit contraction. And so that is what people will think of as a recession. That's, and so that is a short-term debt cycle, and it's reinforcing to the downside as well. When credit contracts, incomes fall, your spending is another person's income. It continues down, and a lot of people get wiped out. They get liquidated. The malinvestment and misallocation of capital gets corrected. And what a lot of people thought they had as an asset, whether it's a promise for someone else to pay them, a bond, or it could be stocks, it could be real estate. What they thought they had, they really didn't. It was just an effect of credit expansion. And so that's about every 7 to 10 years. And you can see that just on like a chart of about interest rates. It's like, it's almost like a wave or something like that. And so a bunch of these small little 7 to 10 year cycles will make up a long-term debt cycle. And this isn't something that like, I don't think necessarily would occur in the wild, or it's just a fact of nature, but with a central bank and centrally controlled price of money, there's these natural short cycles, which put together over a long time span, make up the long-term debt cycle. And so the long-term debt cycle, you can see it on a 100-year chart or 80-year chart. If you look at like the federal funds rate, it's this one big wave. And it peaked in 1980, 1981 up to about 20%. And for the last 40 years, we've gone from interest rates at 20% to today at the zero lower bound. And so when interest rates hit the zero lower bound, it essentially means that the main tool used by central banks to stimulate the economy is no longer an option. So when you cut interest rates, it does a lot of things, but it raises the present value of assets. It makes borrowing easier where you can spend or invest in credit, and it reduces debt burdens. So whenever there's an economic slowdown, central banks, especially over the last 40 years, have cut interest rates. and it's allowed for credit expansion to continue. It's allowed for a lot of people that would get wiped out would not be able to, you know, their investment wasn't a good allocation of capital. It allowed them to escape by. And so we hit the lower bound in 08 or 09. We got back up to about 2% interest rates, and we got cut them back to zero. And that's because debt loads across the economic landscape are so high that they really can't raise interest rates. If they did, everything would basically collapse. So when interest rates hit zero, it's the end of the long-term debt cycle, because unless you can grow your way out of it, which everything, all of the data shows we're not, all we're doing is layering on more and more debt, then the debt loads are unsustainable, and ultimately it's basically a spiral that ends with the currency being sacrificed. And so when you hit the zero lower bound, you can't lower interest rates, the central bank has their main tool, it's gone. And so what they can do from there is they can print a lot of money in the form of quantitative easing, which is buying financial assets. We're seeing that at a massive scale. And the third option, monetary policy three, is it's basically like stimulus checks, direct payments to people, because interest rate reductions and quantitative easing, especially over the last decade, we've seen from 08 to now, on and off, but mostly on, all it does is it pumps financial assets. The bond market is just getting cash shoved in it. These investors seek to redeploy this capital elsewhere. Equities boom, real estate booms, everything is pumping, but that only benefits the investor class. That only benefits the people that hold these assets. And so a lot of the political polarization, a lot of the wealth gap and the rise of socialism and socialist policies, and you know, the leaders on the far left and right, the Trumps and the Bernies and the AOCs and the nationalism and Marxism that arises, it's not coincidence. It's a result of, and the debt cycle doesn't explain all of this. There's a ton of factors at play, but in a simplified way, the polarization of the society results from people feeling like they're cheated. And most people have no understanding or idea of how they're getting screwed. They just know they are. And so we're at a point now where the central bankers and the policymakers are trapped. If they stop the easing, everything would collapse. But if they continue to ease and they continue to maintain the system that is at an endpoint, then the stock market will continue to go parabolic. Asset prices and everything will rise forever. And the lower class, the people that don't have anything to protect themselves, are on a treadmill, and it's a road to serfdom.
And so would you say the central banks, would you say the central bank governments already in a self-destructive mode?
Yeah, and I think they know. I think they're not naive, like, especially, and myself and a lot of people on Twitter and you know, we'll like to clown them and to, you know, say like, oh, you're so oblivious. I think they know, and they're trapped, and they're trapped by decisions that they didn't make. And so you have Jerome Powell going up there with a straight face and saying Fed policy doesn't contribute to wealth inequality. And I think that's somewhat insidious, because a lot of people watching 60 Minutes probably believe that. They don't even know what the Federal Reserve is. And so, yeah, they're trapped, and they're doing everything they can to act like they're not. There's a lot of job owning, and there has been for the last decade, but reality tells a different story. And it's that if they stop the quantitative easing, if they stop the fiscal stimulus, if they stop all of these things, there's a mountain of credit and not even close to enough cash and money to fulfill all of these obligations. And so this huge debt cycle that we've had, the secular downtrend in interest rates and credit expansion, the house of cards would fall down, and it will, but we continue to kick the can down the road. And that's just a result of political incentive. It's, I'm going to get elected as if I'm a president or central bank governor or whatnot, and I'm not going to be the fall guy. You know, everyone's not more of the same, prince of money. Like, you know, everyone's feeling good. Stocks are rising. People feel rich with a $1,200 stimulus check. Like, I'm not going to be the fall guy. And that's just not incentives. These people, I don't think they're inherently bad people. I think they're just trapped in a system that is at this point is lose-lose. It's, they don't have any choices. And so Bitcoin is this natural, I think it's almost like an immune response. Satoshi included in the Genesis block, Chancellor on the brink of second bailouts for the big banks. Or I might have bundled that one, but Bitcoin is a response to this madness. And so this currency regime, this monetary order is in an end game. And people don't know that because they don't know anything else. The long-term debt cycle is something that people don't really understand because most people never, ever live through it. I wouldn't understand it if I wasn't listening to people that said, hey, go read this book and go read some history. And I went and read the history for myself. But what we're seeing today is very, very similar to what we saw almost 100 years ago with the Great Depression and the 1930s and a lot of the side effects
of the wealth
gap and all this stuff.
It's amazing. History is
100%. And
but people seem not to learn out of history. I mean, I always, you know, got to hear that phrase from my history teacher in school. It's like, it would be too good to be true if people learned something out of history. But, you know, this time I think it's not only me, but a lot of people, maybe even you, you know, just it's not only intuitively, but it's like we understand this is our moment. It's Bitcoin or I don't know, humanity's loss. Let me ask you something because, you know, I'm in Austria, so in EU, you know, the people are not much different than in any other countries or continents. I'm in Austria, and for example, I mean, I know there's some data from Germany. They have like 800,000 zombified companies. You have unfunded liabilities. The pension funds are broke. It's really bad. I think people have no idea. They think they're, I don't know, on a blessed island. And they're somehow protected by, by invisible force or something. So I think connecting the dots is really important, especially when it comes to the so-called euro dollar, because it's all interconnected, you know, with the Federal Reserve, the ECB, it's all the same. It's, you know, the owners, controllers of the central banks, who are, by the way, untouchable, unaccountable, and criminally immune. This is something, one of my favorite topics, because it really shows you like how bad the system is, how corrupt and untouchable and unaccountable the system is. What's your take on this, on the whole, you know, central banking structure, inclusion or whatever, as instrumentalized, or the government's being instrumentalized by the central banks?
I think when the money's corrupted, everything is corrupted as a result. And like, I think it's kind of a meme where like any topic comes up and it's like, Bitcoin fixes this. And you're like, if you're that guy, it's like, oh, the Bitcoin guy, like, bringing Bitcoin into this again. But no, there's definitely a truth to it where so many things are broken and incentives are broken and they're warped. People have been lulled deep for not just years, but decades. Their entire lives, like, okay, go to your job and contribute to your pension, who promises 8% returns. 8% of how? Where is that coming from? Like, the last 40 years, like, a lot of boomers and a lot of pensioners, they may actually have made it out. You know, they may have, like, have $1 million from passively contributing to this thing, and they think that they've invested well, but a lot of these returns that they've gotten over the last 4 years is not a result of prudent investing by someone else. Just to put that there, it's not a result of productive investment. It's a result of credit expansion. So when rates go from 20% to zero, and inflation was high in the late 70s, early 80s, but when the discount rate goes from 20, and there is cyclical periods throughout, and they went from 20 to 12 and to 16 to 8 or whatever it was. The discount rate of every asset is crushed, and the asset value source. And so you have all of this pension math, and you have all of these obligations that are promised to people denominated in this currency that there's just been a secular trend of everything goes up. You could have done nothing else but sit in US long dated treasury bonds for 40 years and you would have become filthy rich. And now there's no longer that option, where people are still contributing to pensions. People are still like, I know some people my age that have started to buy index funds, and they think, dude, you make 10% a year. And if I can, and they're like telling me, like, I did the math. If I put in XYZ amount for 20 years, I'll have XYZ amount of dollars when I'm 40. And I'm like, dude, that's not how this works. Like, I tell them to buy Bitcoin, but like, dude, like, this is not just normal. Like, oh yeah, free money. It's 10% a year. It's like, it's the best way to become rich. Just skip your coffee every morning and contribute. And like, this passive investing, like zombification of the economy, all of this, like all of the wacky stuff that people think and perceive as normal is not. Saving money is not a thing. People think saving is investing. People think saving is contributing to their Roth IRA and buying a bunch of index funds that they don't know where the money goes. Like, no, that's not saving. You're investing and you're inherently taking risk. For your original question, the central bank and government, I don't think necessarily, again, like that they're insidious or that they're bad people by any means. It's just there's been an incentive to kind of slowly, it's like a slow default. It's a slow train wreck, and it's crashing in slow motion, and everybody's just kind of along for the ride, and there's no way to turn back on the tracks now. We're going to be rolling off the cliff at some point. I think Bitcoin is our only option. If there was something better or somehow the thesis changed, we're like, we're not blindly following this thing every day. We're questioning what we know and what's true and what's not. And as of now, the thing that I trust the most in this world is running my full node and securing sats, right? Like, I'm not going to trust any politician, no matter how nice he is or what he promises me with a vote. Like, I'm not trusting you with my future because I don't have to anymore. And that's the beauty of it. You don't have to trust anybody. You don't have to put your faith in a corporation or a government or some old dude in a suit for a central bank. And that's the most empowering thing about it.
I mean, you know, we are, let's talk about Bitcoin, but I mean, we are still early. It's like, whatever, 2-3% of the world's population are in one shape or another, whether they're shitcoiners or not. I mean, we've all been there, but let's just say, you know, it's 100 million people. Do you think this hyper-Bitcoinization process, which is so, so early, it's like in the pure mature phase, is it because somehow the critical mass has not been reached who have lost trust, you know, in this, or understood, you know, the monetary, the banking, the central banking system, and you know, the matrix sort of. Do you think this hyper-Bitcoinization process will be triggered once, you know, gradual, and suddenly there's a loss of trust, and this hasn't happened yet, you know, within the European Union or in states or in Canada, whatever, but it hasn't happened yet. Would you say that?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it definitely hasn't happened yet. I think the masses are still lulled to sleep. But at the same time, I don't think it necessarily, I think a lot of people won't ever really, they won't understand what's happening, to be honest. And I think that's just the reality, where I think Saylor explained it pretty good. He's like, Bitcoin and the Bitcoin monetary network and how it scales, it's not like the internet or like a telephone. Like some people talk about Metcalfe's law, and they're like, the amount of users and the amount of addresses on this network, it's the value of the network's the square of the amount of users. And it's like, well, no, it's not how it works. It's about how many people and how much, to quote Saylor, like monetary energy is coming onto this network. So I onboard a lot of people, and I get people stacking, you know, $5 a day, $10 a day, whatever. It could be $1,000 a day. But if I get 40 people or 400 or 4,000, and they're all chipping in here, there, and even if they understand the corruption and like the fallacy of central banking and don't trust their government, that doesn't make as much of a difference as one Michael Saylor or one Elon Musk. It's like them putting $1 billion of monetary energy on this network. So I think what will happen is we're seeing it now. We're seeing, we'll see it over the next few years, I imagine, where a lot of people that in the know, right? Like maybe they're Wall Street guys or cantillionaires, and hopefully not, you know, hopefully the middle and lower class, the people that have been kind of screwed by this monetary system over the last 3-4 decades, hopefully they, you know, a critical mass of these people buy Bitcoin and get on the arc, I guess. But I don't necessarily think that a critical mass of people will wake up. I think it'll be the intrinsic minority that, you know, wakes up, sees how broken this is, and goes all in on Bitcoin. And there's still a very, very small amount of people, but that's, what does that do to the price, right? And price is the ultimate indicator. Price, like a lot of people I know nothing about Bitcoin, but they go, dude, it's gone from 10,000 to 60,000. And when it goes from 60,000 to holy crap, it's 248,000. Why is this? Well, something's happening. And so I think that is going to coincide with losing trust, is like, okay, is Bitcoin pumping or is the dollar dumping? Like at some point it's the Bitcoin adoption curve is like, it overlays with the fall of this monetary system. And I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we have a long way to rip before that, before the mass of people, you know, loses all trust. I think like, it's kind of disgusting how, maybe that's a strong word, but like how much faith people still have after 2020 in these institutions and politicians and all of that. But I think the main sign for people won't be, you know, learning what a decentralized network is or how money is created through credit expansion. They'll just be like, number go up and be like, okay, what's happening? Like, why is this continuing to go? Maybe they don't even understand that the dollar is just tanking. They're like, this thing just goes up forever. Like, I need some. And I think that will just be the natural kind of forcing function.
Yeah. You know, the technological developments, or, you know, the user-friendly applications, whether it be software or, whatever that is, or wallets, it's become like exponentially user-friendly in the last, even, you know, just in the last few months and years. It's amazing. So, and there's so much going on behind the scenes. You know, you mentioned whatever Michael Saylor, and there's so many others with it, BlackRock, I'm just waiting for all the pension funds, you know, who have sort of a fiduciary duty to allocate at least a percentage, whatever that is, 5-10%, whatever, you know, leeway they have into Bitcoin. It's so, I think we're going to see a very sudden process in the next, this is my intuition or my understanding how it will evolve. And yeah, as you said, you know, it's not, you know, the critical mass, you're totally right. It's this transient, whatever it's called, minority, would it be the 10% that's going to like push it like over the cliff. Is that your perception? Yeah. Too? Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I think, for me is like, I kind of focus on like the financial side of Bitcoin and like, and pitching it. And like my latest piece with the debt cycle, it's focused on like the merger of Bitcoin and the legacy monetary system and what it means and how it fits. But yeah, like a big orange pill for people is not like, you know, the investment banker on Wall Street doesn't really care, or at least now they don't think they care about sovereignty and, you know, destroy the governments. And like, it's not like that. It's like, okay, wait, this asset has a higher Sharpe ratio, which is, a Sharpe ratio is max drawdown volatility wise compared to annualized returns. This asset for the last 12 years is returning 200% compounded annually, and people call it so risky and volatile, but the Sharpe ratio on it is higher than any other asset. So why the hell aren't I owning this thing? Or, you know, like, why don't I have a 1% return? I think, like, there's some crazy stats. It's like 5% Bitcoin and 95% cash over the last 10 years. Like, even if you rebalance it every single year, it's like outperforming the S&P by a long shot. And it's like the max drawdown if Bitcoin goes to zero is 5% in that scenario. So people calling it risky don't understand risk. They don't understand what volatility means. So that's like a huge orange pill for people is like, okay, our pensions are super underfunded. We're holding bonds that yield nothing, that with after credit risk and after inflation expectations, and that's assuming CPI is accurate, which I think we both know CPI is a sham. These bonds are negative real yielding. The stocks are trading at 30 PE ratios, all these equities. I should probably own a little bit of this. And there's a game theory there too, where MassMutual buys 100 million and, like, you know, they're the oldest insurance fund in the country. And so their competitor goes, okay, well, I probably need at least a 1% allocation. And that 1% allocation turns to 2, turns to 4. And so I think that's like I focus on the financial side of things because I think that's my edge in articulating the thesis. But ultimately, it's a much deeper Bitcoin, the rabbit hole, the sovereignty, what it does to the nation state. All of this stuff is just like is hidden behind the curtain of like, oh, here. Yeah, just include it in your portfolio allocation. And like, I think Saylor realizes that too. He's like, oh, no, it's not. It doesn't hurt the dollar. Like, oh, it's digital gold and you should have some as a treasury reserve asset. Like, no, he gets it. And like, and for me, like, when I talk with like a finance bro or someone that's like, you know, I'm like, yeah, just add it to your portfolio. It's it reduces your risk and improves your Sharpe ratio. Like, but I think it's much bigger than that. But from the investment side of things, like, mm-hmm. if you're talking to a pension fund, like that's the angle you're gonna approach it at. And they don't understand. Maybe MassMutual does. Maybe some people in their fund do know, but most people don't understand that Bitcoin is the unit of account and that Bitcoin is the risk free rate and that. And like, and all this stuff like volatility matter, and it's a 21 fixed pie. Like, they're not at that level of the rabbit hole yet, but I think they're right there.
Let me ask you. You mentioned Michael Saylor a few times. You know, when he says he overemphasizes every time, you know, his interviews, as if you know, he sounds a little bit like a broken record when he says Bitcoin is and cannot be a currency. I mean, what's a currency? Does it mean like a settlement layer or a medium exchange? Or is that, you know, he knows exactly what he's saying and why he's saying or not saying. Is that sort of a, you know, a Trojan horse, you know, just to keep it low profile? What do you think?
I do believe that. I wrote it's not too detailed. It's just a fun little piece. It's like Bitcoin as digital gold is a Trojan horse. I do think that. I think Saylor understands this at a deep level. And when he is literally saying one day, no, Bitcoin is not a threat to the dollar, and then is speculative attacking the dollar. So if anyone who's listening doesn't know what a speculative attack is, you should look up Speculative Attack by Pierre Rochard. It's on the Nakamoto Institute. It was written in 2014, and it's crazy how far ahead Pierre and Bitstein and these guys at the Nakamoto Institute are, but basically talks about how currency and money, it's all in constant competition with another. And so when going back to the monetary system is when you borrow money, especially in a fiat currency, is you create money. So if I borrow money from you at an interest rate, you now hold an asset from me with plus the interest and I hold the money you have. So it literally creates money. So when Michael Saylor borrows $1 billion to buy Bitcoin, he creates $1 billion new dollars into circulation and takes Bitcoin off the market. And so he is literally attacking the dollar while saying it's not a threat to the dollar. So I do think he knows what he means. And he just getting everybody on a Bitcoin allocation, corporate treasurers, I think that could be one of the things that hopefully helps ease this impending crisis of underfunded pensions and all this stuff. I mean, it would be awesome to see in the United States, but hopefully around the world, where there is somewhat of an ease of transition, and it's not ugly because the game theory of Bitcoin just incentivizes rapid adoption. And so people will be hurt, especially, and I think one of the best things is the people that get wiped out are the creditors, is the people that borrowed all this money, or the people that lent all this money out at zero rates, essentially. You know, if you're buying treasury bonds at this point to, you know, to try to like game the Fed and to sell it to them at a higher price, like, and you're holding the bag, like, great, you got wiped out. I don't think anybody but the quintillionaires are hurt by that, or, you know, the banking system. So I think that's a good thing. But yeah, I think Michael Saylor knows what he's doing, and it's just kind of like a corporate orange pill, and it's effective. I mean, he had that 3 month span where he went on every podcast in the world and you know, talked his book.
So okay, so once we are into, you know, we're already in this competitive game, it seems. I mean, that, you know, I just mentioned, you know, there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes. So you know, whatever countries you take, it's like Iran, you know, trying to circumvent the sanctions by, you know, buying off directly Bitcoin from miners and you know, sort of dictating the price probably, and whatever, or now, you know, with Marty Bent, Great American Mining, or other like upstream data, you know, using the otherwise wasted flared or gases or whatever to mine Bitcoin. So do you think there is this process where we're going into this competitive game where, you know, nation states out of national security reasons are going to, you know, top this? And then we're going into not only decentralizing the mining structures, you know, because there's a lot of FUD going on, you know, China is controlling everything. And so what do you see like in the next few months and years ahead?
Yeah, I definitely, the game theory is going to kick into overdrive. Right now in the mining industry, I don't know too much, but I know that there's a huge semiconductor shortage. That's definitely a result of high demand for Bitcoin mining, but that's just a demand for semiconductors anyway. And so the foundries are all booked, I think, years in advance, and they're building up new foundries as we speak. But yeah, there's that game theory side of things at a nation state level, at a state level, at a municipality level, where if you're not mining Bitcoin as an energy producer, you're at a disadvantage to your competitor. You know, like a lot of these, it's actually kind of beautiful. There's these regulations and all this onerous stuff from the government about flaring, and usually government regulations and whatever, it just adds a ton of inefficiency to the system. But by these bureaucratic regulations and all this stuff, it actually incentivizes Bitcoin mining. It's like, it's actually pretty beautiful where, okay, instead of paying for these flaring operations out of pocket and at a loss, just to burn energy, you can plug in a Bitcoin mining rig, take all this excess methane, which is way worse for the environment, and turn it into CO2, and mine Bitcoin with it. And you have now this digital bearer asset where you can hold it on your balance sheet. You can, you know, if you're, I think Iran, their central bank is buying all of, or they're mandating that the miners sell to the central bank, and Iran sanctioned by the US, and they're one of these countries that at the flick of a switch can get shut off from the SWIFT banking system. And so for them, it's like, okay, well, Bitcoin, I mean, I don't know how much they've adopted, and I wouldn't be surprised if they're holding 100,000 Bitcoin or a significant amount. I think they're incentivized to do so. We don't know, and that's the beauty of it, but that they're being pushed out, like the Russias of the world, the Irans of the world, you know, China. I think it's also encouraging to see like the Peter Thiels of the world, and I forget the senator's name, or one of the guys in the House. Warren Davidson. There was a House Republican leader yesterday that came out on CNBC and basically repeated the same thing. Like, we can't ban Bitcoin because we need to stay competitive. And like, it's awesome to see, because people in the Bitcoin space have been talking about for a while where like the incentives are too strong. And once it reaches this threshold, you can't turn it off. You actually have to ramp it up to compete. And so it's very encouraging to see that from the US's point of view. And I think over the coming years, especially as the price continues to rip, the Bitcoin mining game theory is gonna heat up too, because there right now miners, a lot of like, and it's cool to see. I'm not the big on-chain analytics guy, but I occasionally peek at it, and it's very, very cool to see the miners aren't selling anymore. They're actually net accumulating on top of what they mine. So these miners are issuing, are taking on debt. They're issuing these bonds at almost near zero cost, and they're accumulating Bitcoin on top of covering their expenses and all that. So they're net buyers. And I think it's the best way to get Bitcoin eventually. I mean, you have all this excess energy, nuclear power plants, all this stuff. It's going to kick up in a big way. And I think governments are going to take notice, even if they're sleeping at the wheel at this point.
You know, when because you mentioned the beginning, let me, I want to ask you something about, you know, like the future of humanity and deflationary economies. You mentioned at the beginning, you read also Price of Tomorrow. I mean, I love Jeff Booth. You know, he was on my show together also with also another episode together with Titus Gebel of Free Private Cities. And you know, this is the real reason why I'm into Bitcoin, because I you know, once I understood the fundamentals, the essence and the power of Bitcoin, I mean, we're not going to recognize humanity again, or at least, you know, other civilizations are not going to recognize us anymore. Yeah. Because what do you think, I mean, is going to, because people have no imagination, no comprehension what it means to live in a deflationary economy with deflationary technologies, with the hardest and scarcest money ever created in human history. And the technological innovations, you know, using Peter Thiel's 0-to-1 technological innovation, what is the path towards human civilizational evolution with rooted in Bitcoin? Where do you see that going?
Yeah, I think even when you study it like us and we read these books, and it's really hard to comprehend like how massive this is. People have kind of like been blinded to what's taken place, and this exponential trend of technology and Moore's law and things becoming so advanced so fast, and it's gonna pick up from here with how exponential growth and adoption works. It's unfathomable what it means, and just thinking about like 10 years ago what we had, or the iPhone, or what now, what like what we have in your hand, and to think about what's gonna, you know, what humanity and civilization is gonna look like 50 years from now, is, or even 10, is really mind blowing. So and to kind of think about if we stayed with the current system, or we didn't have Bitcoin, and how civilization and economies and society organize in a system of centrally controlled money and a centrally planned economy, and essentially we're on a trend partially because we're in the end game of our monetary system, and partially because of this technological deflation that is incompatible with the monetary system. We're on this road, the road to serfdom, really. We're on this road where government and these central organizations control everything. And people, essentially, if you extrapolate out, it's going to be, you live in your pod and you get your UBI check and your you know, CBDC currency, and you know, and that's people are like, oh, that sounds great. UBI sounds great. Well, if they can turn it on, they can turn it off.
Yeah, especially if you don't get your vaccination. And, don't forget that, you know.
yeah. I mean, it's a dystopian nightmare, and people can't see the slow creep. And it's really frightening. And so without Bitcoin, I would be very, 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 not depressed. I wouldn't be very hopeful for the future of humanity and liberty and, just, I guess, like, free will. Like it's really a nightmare. And so the fact that we have now this opt-out, which is Bitcoin, and it enables, and it kind of reintroduces free trade. It gets rid of it, abolishes coercion. It's I have this, and if you want to take it, you can't. And if you want to kill me, okay. Like like what's there's no incentive there. The return on violence, which is one of the things in the sovereign individual, it's there is none. It's, you know, I have my wealth in my head or stored geographically distributed in a multi-sig, and if you want to take it, you can't. And so in that world, along with the deflationary aspects of Bitcoin, where as technology continues to exponentially advance, everything becomes cheaper. And you have a world now where, because the money's broken, everything else has a monetary premium. And I think that's another thing where, like, if you say all this to someone in one discussion about Bitcoin, like, just have, you know, nothing about Bitcoin, and I'm just talking to you. You think that, like, you know, I took some shrooms and I've lost my mind. I'm like, yeah, it's going to change the world and everything's going to get cheaper and blah, 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 blah. It doesn't make sense. But when you really think about it and think about it critically and think about every single alternative and extrapolate from there, Bitcoin is our only option. And Bitcoin is by far the best, because without it, we live in a world where we don't control our own destiny as, exactly, as individuals.
We're fucked. Dylan. I mean, humanity is going to be so fucked, you know. I mean, if Bitcoin is succeeding and the cat is out of the bag, and, you know, the Pandora's box opened like 12 years ago, so whatever, 13 years ago. So you know, it's, once people understand, you know, I was just thinking, you mentioned Elon Musk and you know, offering Tesla, you can buy a Tesla for Bitcoin now. But once people understand, you know, you can buy now with less and less, you know, of a Bitcoin, like with a smallest fraction of a Bitcoin, you know, that then, yeah, I think people start understanding the deflationary nature. It means you pay less and less for better and more, you know, and it's so simple. Yeah. Once people understand that, then they understand, you know, the power of abundance, which Jeff Booth is preaching, you know, and yeah.
There's never been an instrument or a technology or a medium where it can absorb all of the world's energy and productivity and be expressed in a way that is completely up to the individual. Like, every single economic decision and trade and interaction can be, you know, it can be kind of, It's all a function of Bitcoin and the price and the free market, and it's all compressed into this one medium, which I think can hold, in today's dollars, hundreds of trillions of dollars of I guess, like, monetary energy, right? Like, all of the things now that have this massive premium, and people just, there's no opportunity cost or perceived opportunity cost to spending, right? Saving is just not a thing. Spending and living, especially in America, where everybody lives beyond their means every single year, perpetually, and have been forever. And that's a result of, like, again, the monetary system, the world reserve currency. Like, Americans spend more than they make every single year forever. And so a lot of these things, naturally, with Bitcoin, they go away. But it's, like, on a deeper level, it's like pretty mind-blowing to think about the chance that Bitcoin can create a type one civilization where we can basically harness all of our energy and human like, our standard of living is just just a derivative of energy production and consumption. And, like, energy is such a bad thing, and, like, oh no, like, and this whole, like, green movement, without people really understanding what energy is and what it means for their life. Like, you're tweeting about how bad energy consumption is in your car on your iPhone.
Exactly. They would have to give up, like, their you know, their standard of life, everything, you know, if it wasn't for energy creation, conversion and production or I don't know, exponential increase of energy. Yeah.
And so Bitcoin is not only a monetary technology, but it incentivizes, with a direct economic incentive, to produce energy at a scale we've never seen, at an efficiency that was never before possible. All of these things, like Marty Bent calls it molecule to market. And it's like, it's really, really crazy to think about what this means for humanity, what this means in the future. It's mind blowing.
Hey, Dylan, I got to get back to my 3 months baby girl and my girlfriend. I could talk to you for hours. It was really amazing, our talks. I really enjoyed this. Is anything we missed, like essentially, like do you want our, you know, and also maybe tell my listeners where they can find you, anything coming up, new articles or anything?
Yeah, I mean, thanks for having me on. It was an awesome talk. Covered a lot of ground. Yeah, you can just find me on Twitter. It's BTC Azation. Yeah, I've worked for Bitcoin Magazine. I don't have any new articles in the pipe, but I'm sure I'll be dropping some soon. And hopefully we can have a talk again sometime.
Definitely, Dylan. Let's repeat this. Okay, Dylan, have a great day. I'll talk to you as soon. Well. Bye-bye. Okay, that was amazing talk. So make sure you follow him on Twitter. It's going to put in the show notes. And his article is on bitcoinmagazine.com, the conclusion of a long-term debt cycle and the rise of Bitcoin. Amazing mind. He's a Zoomer, you know, really super young, like Joe Burnett or William Clemente and so many others. So many great minds out there. So yeah, please follow me on Twitter, subscribe to my YouTube channel and a podcast platform. And just remember, I mean, we're so early, and with these fundamental properties of Bitcoin, the essence of Bitcoin, the absolute scarcity, the magic sauce of Bitcoin, difficulty adjustment, the halvings, the exponential rise in demand, and you know, and then versus the global asset wealth that is in total, which Greg Foss I think quoted something like $900 trillion. I mean, that's going to be sucked into Bitcoin eventually over the months and years and decades to come. So this is going to be a generational wealth that you're going to be, you know, transferring to your children and your children's children. And it's the power of deflationary, you know, money and deflationary technologies, which are going to transform unrecognizably, you know, our human, you know, our miserable human civilization up to now. So thank you so much again for your for listening, for your loyalty, and make sure you follow me. And if you want to support me in any shape or form, you know, send me some sats. And yeah, I'll talk to you soon. If you have any questions, suggestions, let me know. Bye.